Welcome to the Global Research News Hour in the summer. My name is Michael Welch. The Geopolitical Economy Research Group was founded in January of 2015. GERG is a policy research institute conducting high-quality research and analysis dealing with nations and their relation to the world economy. It aims to critically analyze and propose policy alternatives for managing the interaction of national economies and states to promote human development and mutual benefit in today's multipolar world. In September of 2015, the group held its inaugural event at the University of Manitoba, where it is headquartered. The event was entitled, From the 30 Years Crisis to Multipolarity, the Geopolitical Economy of the 21st Century World. On today's program, we're going to hear audio from a panel discussion at the conference. The presentation was entitled, Terror Information and State Secrecy. State governments have long sought to conceal sensitive information from the prying eyes of the public. Government instruments such as Freedom of Information requests are seemingly losing their effectiveness as a means to overcome state secrecy. There is a growing awareness that clandestine discussions within and between nations are favoring major corporate centers of power while excluding the broad citizenry. Emerging over the last decade has been multiple internet platforms, WikiLeaks being chief among these, which allow whistleblowers to upload documents to the World Wide Web for all to see. This form of grassroots hacktivism challenges government control of information and brings substance to the democratic virtue of transparency and openness. Binoy Kampmark spoke at the Geopolitical Economy and Research Group conference on this topic. He's the author of a 2015 paper entitled The Transparency Movement in Geopolitical Economy, WikiLeaks, Economic Diplomacy, and the Redistribution of Power. Binoy Kampmark was a Commonwealth Scholar at Selwyn College, Cambridge. He is currently a senior lecturer at RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia, in the School of Global, Urban, and Social Studies, teaching within the Bachelor of Social Science program in Legal and Dispute Studies. His research and teaching interests lie in the intersections of law, international relations, and history. In his presentation, he invoked the secretive Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement and some of the leaks which have revealed aspects to the deal detrimental to the public interest. So here is Binoy Kampmark from September 2015.
So the first thing to point out here is the notion of this type of activism that I would like to refer to. So some call it a hacktosphere, technosphere, whatever you'd like to deem it. This is sort of nerd central traditionally. Okay, this is a sort of area where individuals with rather bad skin get clocked up and sit in front of a computer for 24 hours. But the actual fact of this, and this is the point to keep in mind, work has been done about it in the context of looking at how such activity has been linked to various spaces of engagement that we're now familiar with today. So for example, what we see now is a combination of journalism, combination of blogging, combination of various social media activism, and of course the legal representation, the legal element of it is important too. A range of individuals who have plugged into these various, if you like, spaces of engagement, which are potentially very exciting, if indeed you are looking at the way government functions, but also the way government doesn't, in some cases, function, keeping information out of the way and so forth. And it is important to understand how that works. Traditionally, information, of course, the arbiter of information, irrespective of what government policy suggests, will always be government. The assumption is a paternalistic one. The assumption always is, we have the information, and, well, you will eventually get some of it through leaked, through gradual process of, for example, declassification programs. There might be, of course, archival programs. And then there is the dispensation that's offered by freedom of information. But freedom of information, of course, does not guarantee when you're putting a request, depending again on which country it's in, but generally speaking, freedom of information is available in many Western states. But the thing is, there is always a limitation to freedom of information because you can still apply for it, and some of you, I'm sure, have probably tried this process, and then you will receive a document which is almost totally blanked out. So it's not as if the process hasn't been complied with. It has been, but you receive essentially a useless document. So that's the process. You get a blank document, or blacked out document, as it were, which is not very useful. The other thing to keep in mind is that when this is challenged in the courts, it's a very familiar test that you always hear, which is the public interest test. But it's not the public interest test for people to know. It is the public interest test for people not to know. That it would be injurious to the public interest to know what the government's up to. Well, yes, of course it would be injurious to know. That's exactly the point. But the whole issue, of course, is that the emphasis is reversed from the public interest of knowing to the public interest of not knowing. And that's an important point to keep in mind, how that particular test functions. And then, of course, the other technique, or the other method, if you like, is the notion of other methods where information is obtained, be it, for example, via whistleblowing, which has, of course, landed individuals in a considerable amount of strife. I don't need to tell you that in the context of WikiLeaks, of course, Chelsea Manning is paying a very high price for the disclosure of documents that ultimately led to Cablegate, as it's been termed. And then there is, of course, the traditional hacker and so forth, where that's particularly linked. But in terms of the whistleblowing aspect, I also want to point out something. I always get very suspicious when there is a supposedly new whistleblower law coming about to protect whistleblowing, because, again, just as the onus in freedom of information is designed to prevent the public from actually knowing in their good name, the whistleblower is presumed initially not to be doing the right thing. You see, this is the problem with whistleblower legislation. The assumption is that you have done the wrong thing, and then you must justify that you did the right thing. So it is a retrospective validation about an act to begin with. And that is how the institutionalized establishment retains control of information, so that effectively the information is kept, as I like calling it, in the family or the mafia. So effectively, the security mafia or the intelligence establishment or whatever it might be, it may not necessarily be that that valuable information, but to give you an example, the various countries, the UK, for example, or Australia, do have very strong laws, very punitive laws for the disclosure of any information as a public servant, former or ex, former or current. So it doesn't actually matter that it's about the number of biscuits in the jar of the Secretary of State. Okay, that's punishable. 2 years in prison by just disclosing that fact. Now, that's the law as it is. The Public Interest Disclosure Act that was passed in Australia last year has been hollowed out extensively by new rules and regulations that show that Edward Snowden never happened. And in fact, that's the very interesting thing about this whole thing. This entire movement about supposed protection of disclosure, so-called public internal disclosure, which you can see the problem with that, it's internal. It's called public internal disclosure. It's very peculiar. So, but anyway, the point I simply want to draw with that is this enveloping notion of information, which then presents us with a situation such as publishing in the format of a WikiLeaks experiment, if you like. That's what bridges the gap and so forth. And the examples connected with that I want to discuss are, of course, those connected with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is, I want to add, only one of a series of a triad of agreements that will ultimately encompass the globe. Well, with the exception of BRICS countries, that's the thing. The whole point about these particular agreements act, if you look carefully at the geographical nexus and component of it, as an envelopment, that comprises something like 50 countries and, literally two-thirds of GDP of the world. More of that later. But to continue on the actual dimensions of this type of activism, I want to refer to the work of John Postel, who's done some work in this area, quite interesting. He's argued for what he calls the mainstreaming of nerd politics. He actually argues that this particular situation is facing us today. And what is interesting to see is the use of, for example, actor network theory that Latour discusses, and how it relates to social processes as humans, human agency, human engagement, but also the use of inanimate processes in linked with that, with the activism. So, for example, the use of the internet, the use of social media, of course, the uploading of documents that might be deemed of a sensitive nature. In other words, it's the naturalization of that sort of technology that's taking place as we speak. Now, Postol argues that we need to describe such activism in a new light, namely, that there are component and groups of people that take advantage, if you like, of societal forces that we see happening, be it, for example, what led to the Arab Spring, be it examples that lead to Cablegate and so on and so forth. So these are anywhere, from what I said before, bloggers, hacktivists. There might be technology lawyers. There might be social media netizens and so forth. Now, he calls them freedom technologists. He calls them freedom technologists who use specific type of protest formula to engage, for example, the exposure of corruption of particular individuals. You could already see this happening, for example, in 2001 with the use of mobile phone technology with Estrada in the Philippines. You could also see this, and this was already happening even before the WikiLeaks cables in Tunisia with Ben Ali, because you could already see that what was happening there was a broader discussion, new spaces of engagement that in effect the government wasn't even observing. In effect, it was taking place ahead of government regulations, ahead of the actual, if you like, orthodoxy of the time. Now, the important thing is Postol suggests that we should not be as negative about these technologies as some people have been. And I understand where they're coming from. People like Yevgeny Morozov, for example, who makes the very important point that this sort of, you know, liberation idea behind technology can also be fraught with danger. You know, he calls them slacktivists and, of course, techno-delusionists. And it is important to also understand that it is very hard to gauge causation here necessarily. You know, just because one reads a cable that's been put on the WikiLeaks, you know, via WikiLeaks on the server, does that necessarily mean that, you know, a government's going to fall? Of course, not necessarily. But it is important to realize the combination of factors within the particular phases of how a particular revolt or revolution works. My feeling always has been that three quarters of the work is already done by the government if a government falls. You know, in a sense, the explosion or the catalyst comes from these particular range of factors, of which WikiLeaks is one. So a very nice thing that was said, or a very prescient point, was that the collapse or the initiation, perhaps, of the Arab Spring and the collapse of various leaders took place because of Al Jazeera, Emil, and WikiLeaks. Now, of course, it's a bit of simplification, but what it meant is people there looking at television networks, gauging with the material that's coming out, and then, of course, various networked communities protesting and arranging protests through various avenues using material that had come out in the disclosures about the behavior, for example, of Ben Ali, who had a range of exotic animals and very strange eating habits with ice cream. So the point about this is to understand that this, what has been termed, if you like, this particular fourth wave of democracy. Now, I don't like these particular categorizations, waves of democracy, new movement, and all of that. But I think it is important to understand that within the context here, we are talking about new spaces of media and engagement which have not been anticipated by government. Gradually, as governments are starting to get their head around these technologies, they're starting to utilize those same technologies, of course, against individuals who might actually have a sense of them. We see that constantly in terms of social media propaganda units that are funded by various countries. Israel has a very active unit. The Russians are particularly adept at this too. A range of things there which are worth considering. But the point about this particular wave was that it was the creation of new various media channels. It was also the creation of media that was not in the standard state-run aspect. And this combined with the publishing activism of a group like WikiLeaks or, say, Anonymous, presented itself in a particular formidable way. So that is the activism side of it, that dimension of how activism has utilized the technological framework to create, as it were, a bit of a ruckus as to whether, you know, it creates genuine change or not is, of course, the open question. But the policy behind an organization such as WikiLeaks is that it deals with this notion of transparency. Now, of course, within transparency, there are various tools of thought. The more traditional one that you might be familiar with is associated with Transparency International. Now, Transparency International has essentially an interest in government functions insofar as they affect things like efficiency and so forth. So the notion with Transparency International, generally speaking, I don't want to simplify the platform too much because I do understand that the organization and its various branches does many things, but the important thing to also understand that essentially it's the assumption from an economic rationalist perspective. It's the idea that if you are not transparent, you will be inefficient and so on and so forth. And that's really the line taken by organizations such as the IMF, you know, to use a word that's been used often at this conference, this is a neoliberal framework, if you like, that uses transparency as an argument. So that's why transparency in some instances may have a dirty name, you know, if it's taking that perspective. But this particular point here is a very much public interest-driven idea of what's called radical transparency. Or I'd like to give it a little another term, bushranger transparency, you know, vigilante transparency. It's this idea that it is left out there, the material is published, and this particular material is accordingly interpreted in what is called the scientific journalistic sense. At least this is how Julian Assange describes it. Namely, it is unfiltered. You don't actually have a cast, as it were, of individuals engaging this. I see parallels in this with Martin Luther's, of course, stamping of the theses on the wall of the church in Wittenberg. And this is the idea, of course, that God should not be obscured by the priests. You should not have a medium, if you like, intervening that tells you how you should interact with that material. God of the text, the material, of course, being obscured by the priests. So in this particular instance here, what has been described as, and this is a particular line taken from Sifri, the idea is to eliminate the big brother, if you like, that watches from above, and replace that with a flock of little sisters watching government from below. So that's one of the ideas put forth. But then I also want to stress that I'm not suggesting that secrecy is all dirty. I think it's a very important point that in an examination of radical transparency itself, it's not necessarily and does not necessarily mean that you know, we have to abolish all forms of it. I'm just suggesting, as Claire Birchall does, who's done quite a bit of work in radical transparency, Claire Birchall suggests actually that we should see them as feeding off each other rather than totally mutually exclusive of each other. There may be reasons and rooms, and certainly room for engagement in this particular thing. It shouldn't be seen as the notion of transparency as secrecy and secrecy as transparency. We have to try to work out various forms of engagement there in terms of that. Now, what I would like to move on to is, as I said before, to examine the actual Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is, if you like, the case study for our discussion today. Now, November 13, 2013, WikiLeaks released the intellectual property rights chapter of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Those of you who are perhaps not familiar with the dimensions of this, it's considerable. 13 countries are involved with negotiations over a range of things, which will be very significant in the long run. They may well affect, for example, the way the internet is used in certain cases, certainly the way medicine is made, the way patents are granted, and the way certain things with intellectual property and the environment are, for example, dealt with. And just incidentally, that on 24th of November, the chapter, the environmental chapter, was released. Now, all of these constitute, as I said before, part of a treaty triad, with the TPP being essentially the icebreaker. Now, the icebreaker here means that effectively the global economy comprising, say, 53 states and 1.6 billion people will be affected by these particular arrangements. They comprise the Trade and Services Agreement, otherwise known as TISA, and also the Transatlantic Investment Agreement, which comprises Europe, the EU. So it's the EU and the US on the one side, and then the US comprised with countries through the Asia-Pacific. So that's effectively rings both with the EU on one side with the Atlantic, and then the Pacific, of course, on the other side with the Asia-Pacific. This is also part of President Obama's pivot strategy as well. So when he made it clear that, yeah, and he has said, in fact, a few times that should the TPP pass, and, you know, there is suggestions, there always are suggestions that it will pass soon, but there have been quite a few delays, that if it passes, for example, later this year, it will be one of the crowning achievements of his administration. Well, according to WikiLeaks, they'd like to see what's going on there. So a couple of crowdsource mechanisms have been put into place. Seeking funding, you may or may not be familiar. Your places of employment may frown upon you if you're there browsing the WikiLeaks website. And it has happened. I certainly know of instances, even in the university setting, where students have been found out using that material and gotten into trouble, which is rather curious. I know there was a debate in the United States about whether you could use WikiLeaks cables in class or whether you could tell students to use those cables. I can't speak about it from the Canadian perspective. I'm not sure if it was done here as well. But when Cablegate did come about, various institutions, for example, Georgetown University, certainly issued an email specifically in the diplomacy area that if you are reading WikiLeaks cables, then you are jeopardizing your career, potentially. So the point about this part, and not wanting to get off that, but get back to specifically obtaining the document, and this is again linked back to that sort of activism. WikiLeaks is seeking 100,000, so it's through pledges essentially, 100,000 euros for the transatlantic agreement partnership, and for the trans-Pacific partnership, $100,000. And the point about this, of course, is actually involving public or citizenry into identifying the remaining chapters of the TPP. So if any one of you have the contents out there, 100,000 up for grabs, depending on which ones, well, what you're looking for. Yeah, so the point about this here is, why the fuss? Now, the thing about it is that the TPP has been considered, for example, NAFTA on steroids. I mean, this will make NAFTA look like a kindergarten sport. Okay, when it comes down to it, I know Ross Perot does make some curious remarks, but you know, he does say that if it is passed, there'll be a big sucking sound of jobs leaving the US. But leaving that aside, it's not even the implications of those things. It's also the fact that it is very much in favor of corporates over citizenry. And it also, and this is the thing that's perhaps most striking, it's gagging parliamentarians. It's gagging Congress individuals, congressmen and women, from saying anything about it. You can see it, but you can't speak about it, which is one of the reasons why Senator Elizabeth Warren did actually say that this is in all likelihood probably a bad sign. The fact that the citizens who elect a particular individual can't then expect that individual to tell them exactly what is going on. The actual documents are very interesting to read. They have red lines that show the engagement, for example, of the various parties. So it's a study of forms of diplomacy as well. You can see, for example, the disagreements over fisheries in the environmental chapter. You can see, for example, the disagreement about patents, New Zealand being particularly upset with the United States stance on generic drugs. And the fact that patents will be extended in length and royalties will be extended in length by 20 years. This is one of the proposals. So effectively, that will be an attempt to kill off the generic drugs industry, and rather than encourage innovation, stifle it. This is one of the curious things about it. Other parts of it speak of voluntary compliance of corporations for an environmental code. So effectively, if you notice carefully about it, the environmental chapter is a trade-off for a very forceful IP chapter. In other words, you lessen the environmental protections in favor of corporate copyright issues and IP, which is a very interesting but rather glum sort of thing to look at. It also, certainly the IP chapter, reintroduces SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act. The provisions of that act were rejected in Congress, but these provisions are then reinserted into what certainly the document we have looks like. I'm not saying word for word it is, but it's certainly reinserting the spirit of the Piracy Act, which would have, if it had been passed, make ISPs, internet service providers, the police men and women and officers, if you like, of the net, namely to take down particular sites that were in copyright violation and to essentially make them police it. The other thing that's very problematic is the investor dispute settler provisions. This means that corporations effectively can sue governments for diminished profits. This is a very, and what is so bizarre about this is that this has been tried and failed miserably. Australia, the Australian government should know, because it inserted exactly that provision with, for example, this was actually with Hong Kong, interestingly enough, and this provision actually allows corporations to sue on it. And guess who's suing the Australian government? They're currently in their third year of litigation. And that's, of course, tobacco companies. So the tobacco companies have argued that because in Australia, I don't know if you're familiar, there's some very tight regulations on tobacco advertising. 2 years ago, the Australian government introduced blank. You could only have on your tobacco containers and cartons and so forth images of dying people. You couldn't actually have anything else. Yeah. That's all. So, of course, you know, the various tobacco companies got rather upset. Philip Morris got very upset. They decided to sue the Australian government for lost revenue. And that's still ongoing. And that is because of this type of provision, the investor dispute provision. So what I'd like to do, since I'm wary of the time, is I'd like to just mention a few points about the activism in response to the TPP. Some have argued, in fact, that the TPP, the debates about it, and the discussions surrounding the leaks, if you like, suggest a reinvigoration of the debates about globalization and so on. It's just taken a different form. After 9/11, a lot of those debates seem to wither away. But what has happened since then is a reinvigoration. I can certainly speak of a whole plethora of grassroots organizations that have grown up in response wanting to discuss the TPP, wanting to discuss the implications of that particular document. I can tell you personally, for example, of certain groups, and interestingly enough, groups that have arisen with a very varied demographic. So, for example, in Melbourne in Australia, there's a particular well-heeled area called Goldstein. And that particular area has a get-up group that's very active. And that particular get-up group has individuals who want to see the implications of what's in the document. So they've been lobbying the trade minister, Andrew Robb, about the subject, and have asked him for briefings, and he's been very mute about it. He's not particularly interested in discussing the implications of this. Secrecy is fundamental. And in a more physical sense, people have also taken to the streets. I can tell you, for example, in New Zealand in August, just last month, there was a considerable number of protests across 21 cities, in fact, and they did number in the thousands. I don't ever want to exaggerate the numbers, but there was a genuine argument about the TPP, and added, of course, to this a plethora of organizations with websites and information. There is certainly discussion about how these particular things are working. So in conclusion, in sum, as it were, I'd like to mention some of the points that I've made today. Firstly, we're talking about the mainstream application of what might have been deemed marginal before, namely the use of certain technologies by marginal groups, say the hacktivism aspect, and brought it into a mainstream protest format. And that is a particularly interesting period, and that suggests a sort of redistribution of, at least to a certain extent, power. I can't, of course, say how much in terms of its evaluative sense at this point. We are talking about new brands of engagement, as it were. But ultimately, as I've said before, and I think it's a very important point, the movement here suggests that we should have, and we should take the discussions out of the boardroom, which is where a lot of these things are taking place, and put them in the public sphere where representative government is most importantly represented, namely for the people. And that's the point that I suppose a lot of these ideas I'm discussing today stem from. Okay, thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We air on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the World Wide Web at globalresearch.ca. On today's program, we're listening to audio from the Geopolitical Economy Research Group Conference held at the University of Manitoba in September of 2015 on the topic of terror information and state secrecy. Paul Zaremka is professor of economics at the State University of New York at Buffalo. He's been the general editor for Research in Political Economy since 1977. He was also the editor of the 2008 volume The Hidden History of 9/11. In the presentation which you're about to hear, Zaremka introduces the theme of a paper then under development entitled A Challenge for Geopolitical Economy, September 11th and Conspiracy Theory. Professor Zaremka argues here that the term conspiracy theory is an anti-intellectual concept and makes his point by invoking a few of the problems with the official 9/11 story and lessons from a history before conspiracy theory became a pejorative. So here is Paul Zaremka on the Global Research NewsHour.
I know that there are people out there who, you know, label people like myself conspiracy theorists in a kind of a negative way. I mean, I go back at the beginning to Adam Smith, and I have in my paper a condensation of a short passage in Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, which I will read. I'll try and read a little bit slowly. It's not too long, so we should be okay. Here he goes. We rarely hear it has been said of the combination of masters, though frequently those of workmen. Now, stop for a second. Combinations here could be conspiracies or unions or whatever. Workmen, of course, would be, you would think of as probably unions. But whoever imagines upon this account that masters rarely combine is as ignorant of the world as of the subject. Masters are always and everywhere in some sort of tacit but constant uniform combination. And then he's now referring to the rise of the, not to have the rise in the ways of, wages of labor above their actual rate. Masters too sometimes enter into peculiar combination to sink the wages of labor even below this rate. These are always conducted with the utmost silence and secrecy till the moment of execution. Now, I mean, he doesn't use the word conspiracy theory here or anything like conspiracy. I mean, like the word conspiracy theory, but he does have the concept of conspiracy. So we then could go and examine the next person who I think is probably gets a lot of attention in this conference, and that would be Karl Marx. And he had some very insightful discussion about the coup d'etat in 1853 by the second Napoleon. And that's Louis Napoleon. And that was a very insightful discussion, which at the time people condemned, but later they found out that basically he was an accurate representation of what was going on at that time. And again, he's describing a conspiracy. I mean, some of it is absolutely remarkable description of the conspiracy that was going on at the time. So I'm trying to say, well, look, Adam Smith, Karl Marx both have done discussions of conspiracy, so we should not be ashamed of working on conspiracy issues. Now, the next thing I want to mention is the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and I'm going to make that in a kind of an interesting context, I think. The Pope was in New York City yesterday giving a speech before the United Nations, and he made a reference to Abraham Lincoln, Martin Luther King Jr., to Thomas Merton, and to the founder of the Catholic Worker, Dorothy, slipped my mind. What's interesting about this is that Thomas Merton basically predicted the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Basically, he said that John F. Kennedy was moving toward peace, and therefore he was subjecting himself to assassination. The book that makes a combination or an interface between Thomas Merton and the John F. Kennedy assassination is this book by James Douglas, JFK and the Unspeakable, and it has a subtitle, Why He Died and Why It Matters. It's, from my point of view, the first time I read a study of the assassination of Martin Luther, of John F. Kennedy, which convinces me completely that he was in fact assassinated by agents of the United States government, particularly the CIA. He does it, however, not, I mean, he almost proves who did it, but he doesn't even consider that is the main issue. The main issue for him is the fact of what Kennedy stood for and how Kennedy was changing toward promoting international peace. And that's what subjected JFK for the potential for being assassinated. In fact, he was assassinated. An aspect of the book which is important, I think, is that he also describes JFK as a person who had been subject to near death several times in his life, had a lot of personal health problems, and therefore is described as someone who passed beyond the fear of death. And I think that's an important aspect because a lot of discussions about controlling leaders has something to do with being able to blackmail them. And in some sense, James Douglas is arguing that Kennedy was not really subject to blackmail, at least in that dimension. So anyway, I recommend that book by James Douglas. That's two S's at the end, JFK and the Unspeakable. And he connects it to Thomas Merton quite a bit, actually, because he's a Catholic theologian. And I was just struck by the fact that Thomas Merton was one of four people that the Pope brought up yesterday. But he also brought up Martin Luther King Jr., who obviously everybody knows was murdered. And the question is, was he just simply murdered or was he assassinated? As thinking of assassination is when some larger power than some individual does it. And that is quite an interesting story. The person who confessed to doing it is a man named James Earl Ray. Now, King was assassinated in April of 1968. And after some search and what the things are another, which we could talk about, they apprehended James Earl Ray, and he eventually confessed to it, which allowed him to avoid a trial jury, and was able to be sentenced to life imprisonment, as opposed to the threat of being assassinated. So one can speculate that that had something to do with his confession. I make a comment that I was speaking with a prosecutor a few days ago, a couple weeks ago, and the prosecutor commented that confessions are actually one of the weaker elements of a conviction of a person, because very often confessions really are undertaken for misleading reasons which are not describing the truth of the matter. Anyway, James Earl Ray, 3 days after he arrives in the penitentiary to begin to execute his life sentence, recants his statement that he had murdered Martin Luther King Jr. And basically, for the rest of his life, he fought to be able to have a new trial, which was never successful. However, he had Martin Luther King had a friend who was a lawyer named William Pepper. And Pepper was very much a part of the anti-war movement, which King became in the last year of his life. And he knew King well. And he was shocked, of course, by King's murder, and basically for, just assumed that James Earl Ray had assassinated King, and that lasted for about 10 years until the head of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference had his suspicions and wanted to interview James Earl Ray and asked William Pepper to go with him, and he did, and to collapse the story a bit, the more they got to know about James Earl Ray and beginning to study the evidence, the more convinced they became that he really did deserve a new trial. There was many attempts being made to be able to get the new trial, which, as I have already said, was never successful, but the end result was that around 1998, actually it was a couple years before that, in 96, the King family wanted to help James Earl Ray have a trial, so I think the entire family was on board with this. But in 1998, James Earl Ray died. And so they had to decide what to do. And that became a rather tense decision because you could no longer focus on the person who had been who had confessed and was therefore in jail. But so they changed the question to the conspiracy that was undertaken by the owner of the bar across from the motel where James Earl Ray, I mean, where Martin Luther King was assassinated, and other co-conspirators. So then I'm going to put up now the book that resulted from that. This is the An Act of State, which is basically a description of the trial and the after effects of the trial and how to get to the trial that William Pepper undertook as the lawyer for the King's family. They asked only for $100. The issue was not the money, obviously. The issue was to get the truth out. And so you can read the overwhelming evidence that it was a conspiracy and it was not that James Earl Ray had nothing to do with it. And the trial jury had six whites and six blacks, and they convicted, they reached a guilty verdict within 1 hour, and that's both the co-conspirator of the Lloyd Jowles, who is the guy, the owner of the bar across from the motel, as well as unnamed government agents, which would include agents of, at the national level, state level, and the local level, some of which they kind of know exactly who it was, but they don't know the whole pictures. But anyway, the judge awarded, I think it was 70%, the judge described 70% of the conspiracy as on the part of agents other than the Lloyd Jowers. So what is the importance of that? The importance of that is that here is a trial for conspiracy in part by the United States government against Martin Luther King Jr. And that trial, actually, when I asked people even just a few, last weekend, if somebody who knows a lot of history did not know about that trial. Why? Because almost nobody attended that trial. There was one reporter from Portugal, which has a connection to the trial, who did attend the trial. There was one local reporter who, for a while, lost his job because he attended the trial. And the third person was precisely the same James Douglas I mentioned before, who sat throughout the trial. Those are basically the only three people that sat throughout the trial. And the press didn't cover it. I mean, there was maybe a New York Times mention on page 19 of down at the bottom, you know, that's about it. So it's a quite unknown outcome, but it's a case where you take a conspiratorial situation to a jury trial and get a verdict. So what's my point is I'm again indicating that we should treat, in geopolitical economy, we should treat conspiracy not only as something that happens and we just kind of say it but don't study it, but we actually have to take account. We actually have to take account of the use by the state of conspiracies. And that, of course, then takes us to the issue of September 11th, for which there's a lot of people who are working on it these days. But there's also a lot of people who don't want to hear a thing about the fact that September 11th could have been a conspiracy. The main point I'm trying to drive home is that for this discussion is that we have to take the possibility that the September 11th event was an out-and-out conspiracy, and we can talk about, if we want, who it might have been, and I'm fully prepared to do that, but I'm not going to focus on that today. What I do want to mention is the thing that I want to start with, the thing that, gets me the most angry, and that is if you read the 9/11 Commission report, which came out in 2004, there's not a single attempt to prove that any of the hijackers are on the plane. They simply state, they basically assume their conclusion and go on from there. They don't even say where they got the names from, although they would probably say they got it from the FBI. So, September 11th, for me, got me most angry. I will say I didn't react immediately. This took me about a half a year before I got involved. But my sense of justice requires that if you're going to convict people and you're going to start a whole perspective of how the world should change as a result of what happened on September 11th, you ought to have a totally convincing case about who the perpetrators were. And the 9/11 Commission report didn't even mention it, didn't even talk about it, okay? They just assumed that these 19 people did what was said that they did. And there's some cases where I could talk, for example, I could talk, and I do in my paper, about one individual named Jara, who was in charge of the alleged pilot of the plane United Airlines 93. I so happen to have heard a video of his uncle in Lebanon. Okay, while he was a Muslim, he actually went to a Catholic university, and he was not religious particularly. I heard an interview of his uncle who just said that in his family, of course, if you hear that somebody in your family does something so horrible as that, of course you're going to spend a lot of time trying to digest it and trying to understand if it could possibly have happened. Anyway, the family came to the conclusion, no, he might have been on the plane, but he certainly was not, would not be a person who would ever do something like that. So the first point I want to make is that if you're going to convict 19 alleged hijackers of doing something, then you ought to have a real proof for it, and the government did not even attempt to offer a proof. So that's an opening. Now, as an economist, I also studied insider trading before 9/11, and I will skip to that and then come back to some other issues. Before 9/11, there was events called put option trading in both American Airlines and United Airlines. And those are the two planes, airline companies which were involved. Basically, there was a large increase in put option trades on both those airlines. Now, put option trade means that sometime in a defined future, but at any time the stock market is open, you can sell that stock at whatever the prices that you have contracted for. You can sell at whatever price you contracted for. So, for example, those two airlines had stock prices coincidentally around $30 on that day. Before that day. And if you put a put option at $30 for, let's say, the next month and a half, which is, by the way, more or less what happened, for the next month and a half, and the stock price falls, you can still sell the stock at $30. That's what a put option allows you to do. And what in fact happened is that both those stocks went down to about $17 or $18 in the follow-up through the September 11th attacks. And the consequence was that anybody who had put a put option could sell those stocks for $30 after they buy them for $18, $19, $17. It cost you a little bit of money to buy the put option, but it might be a half a dollar, it might be a dollar. So you can make quite a bit of money if you know ahead of time what's going to happen. And there is not just those two airlines, but other airline stocks and other financial stocks, all of which had increase in put options. Now, one could say, well, okay, fine. But there have been three academic studies, all now published, one of which is in the Journal of Business, which nobody can accuse of as being anything other than a mainstream financial publication, and two other publications, one of which just was published within the last month, okay? All of which, in their different ways, come to the same conclusion, that there was substantial put option trading that had occurred before September 11th. What that means that people, that there were people who knew it ahead of time and were taking advantage of the upcoming event. And when you look at the 9/11 Commission report, they just have one paragraph and one footnote about what actually became a mainstream article for about 1 month after September 11th. I think the people who, I mean, those data are publicly available data. I think the people who are making comments did not know where it was leading. They thought it would lead to Osama bin Laden. And I think there was somehow a put down of the whole discussion once it was realized that it wasn't going to lead to Osama bin Laden. I would make a comment here that, I mean, I've done enough similar economic research to know that when you have a controversial conclusion like this, namely put option, taking advantage of put option before September 11th, that there would be other people writing articles which would contest that conclusion. In this particular case, there has been nobody, which is no academics that I have seen, who have contested these findings. And I don't think that means that it couldn't be done. I think it means that people are so scared of even talking about it that they don't even want to look, that they don't even want to consider that if they did the research, they might confirm rather than disconfirm the results. In other words, I'm suggesting that there is a fear inside the academe to arrive at such conclusions. Okay, so that's the second point I want to make about September 11th. But the one that's getting a lot of attention is that there was not just two skyscrapers that fell on that day, and it was the World Trade Center 1 and 2, which has been shown over and over and over and over and over and over again. There was also a third building, the World Trade Center 7, which collapsed at 5:20 in the afternoon. All three collapses look like a normal controlled demolition. What does that mean? If the buildings had been hit by an airplane and that actually caused the building to collapse, it would have been done in a way which weakened the side of the building in which the planes came in, and more so than elsewhere, and you would have expected the buildings to tilt over rather than go straight down. And if it had been done by a gathering fire in the building, you would expect the building to slowly sort of come down. But in fact, all three of these buildings came down more or less at the fall of gravity. A little bit slower than the fall of gravity, but we're just talking about like seconds. How much more time do you want me to take?
5 minutes, please.
Okay, that's fine.
Great. Thank you.
For example, the two World Trade Centers came down in about 12.7 seconds, and the World Trade Center 7, which was a 47-story building, came down within, 9 seconds, which is almost the fall of gravity. which suggest what? It suggests that the underpinnings of all three of those buildings somehow had gotten rid of and forced the building to simply collapse, and it collapsed on its own footprint, which is the dramatic part of it. It's what a controlled demolition does when you want to bring down a building. We don't yet know, I mean, some people think they know, I don't know exactly how it was done. I mean, we do know that the 9/11 Commission report and then the National Institutes of Standards and Technology, which was supposed to be investigating all these buildings, they did not test for whether there was explosive materials in the dust down from the that came down in the building. I happen to personally know a woman who survived in an apartment building across the World Trade Center who did collect dust and handed the dust over to a physicist who did analyze and did find that there was explosive materials in the dust. But the 9/11 Commission report nor the National Institute of Standards and Technologies ever investigated on their own whether there was explosive materials in the dust. We also have the issue of the Pentagon, and I think we just have a bit too little time for me to describe in detail, but let me just say that there are eyewitnesses, I mean a considerable number of eyewitnesses who were in a position to actually see how the plane came in, and it did not come in toward the Pentagon from the direction that the 9/11 Commission report describes, and in fact that suggests that the plane itself was not responsible for whatever happened at the Pentagon, that it could have been a explosives preset in the Pentagon or perhaps a cruise missile that went into the Pentagon, not an American Airlines Flight 77, as was described. There's also issues about phone calls from the planes. It actually is impossible at that time, and even now it's difficult, to use cell phones from higher than 2,000 feet. A lot of the initial news reports claims that people on the planes were making phone calls, even at 35,000 feet, from a cell phone. When you finally got to the trial of Moussaoui in 2006, the government had backtracked on that and said only that the cell phone calls are made when the planes are close to the ground, and that meant that all the other calls had to be made from air phones. But then there's the issue about some of those planes didn't have air phones in the back of the seats. So that's a whole issue we could discuss in greater detail. We also have the issue of what actually happened in the Pentagon. I mean, not the Pentagon, the plane that crashed in Pennsylvania. And there's people who say that they saw that the plane was shot down, which actually would not be unreasonable to shoot down the plane. If the other three events were correctly described, you would expect that, you know, if there's a real conspiracy to bring down the World Trade Centers and the Pentagon, you would think you'd want to protect whatever the other plane was going to do. But anyway, the government claimed no, that it was taken over.
That was Paul Zaremka speaking at the September 2015 Geopolitical Research Group Conference in Winnipeg on A Challenge for Geopolitical Economy, September 11th, and Conspiracy Theory. For more information on the Geopolitical Economy Research Group and the September 2015 conference, please visit the website gergconference.ca. You've been listening to Global Research News Hour in the summer. You can download our shows from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on our program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. My name is Michael Welch.